Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
And welcome to the new edition of TLS Voices. My name is Stig Abel, editor of the Times Literary Supplement. I'm joined as ever by commissioning editor and apparently infallible figure, Thea Leonard-Dutsey. Thea, one of your fellow editors, Catherine, said in my request for dirt that she had some, but she won't share it with me. And then I hear today you went out for lunch with everyone from the office and only ordered chips.
Yeah, and one small beer.
That, as a foodie, is that acceptable, do you think?
Probably not. I had an orange when I got back to the office. It was an express meal.
Express meal, chips and orange. But if anyone does have any dirt on Thea, please do tweet me at Stig Abel.
Sorry, Lucy, could you just pass me the copy of the employer's handbook?
I think it's okay. I checked.
I'm also an employment lawyer. Just like to say, I'm very much on the case here.
Freelance employment. Yeah.
Lucy, we're going to come to your multiple identities
very
shortly.
I'll be quiet. Yeah. Don't worry.
Thea, I want to talk about the future of the podcast because we're going to have a relaunch potentially as early as next week to celebrate its success. We're definitely going to rename it, aren't we? The name is lovely and it's your idea. So what is the new name of this podcast going to be?
Instantly forgotten it. No, I'm joking. It's Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon.
And that is because?
That is, it references Oscar Wilde because he said, of course, with Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, how could I not be happy? And I'm not clear on when precisely he said it. I'm presuming, he knew all about those things. I'm presuming he said it after Reading Jail.
It's a lovely statement. Actually, and so that's what the podcast can be called, Freedom, Books, Flowers
and
the Moon.
I like to think it gives a sense of our range.
Yeah, it's lovely. I mean, it's going to have its own Twitter feed and the like. So it'll probably be next week. So next time you listen to this, it may be retitled, relaunched and sounding a little jazzier. If you are listening and don't already subscribe to the TLS, here is an offer for you. If you Google TLS subscriptions, click on the page and type POD1 into the offer code bit, you can get 6 issues for just £6, which is value for money, I think. And I've got to remind you also, if you want to support this podcast, whatever it's called, please do review us on iTunes as well. Coming up on this week's show, it's our musical special in the TLS this week, curated, if I'm allowed to use that modish verb, which I don't think I am, by our arts editor and quondam indie pop miserabilist, Lucy Dallas. As regular listeners will know, Lucy famously does not read the TLS newspaper, so it is a rare moment indeed to discover an edition in which she has not only read it, but edited many of the articles. And on that basis, we thought she should join us for the podcast. So welcome, Lucy.
Thank you very much. As usual, I disagree with or would have issue with,
speak to my lawyer.
Yes, 75% of what you've said there. Fine, but I think is a bit less than last time.
Yeah, no, exactly. I'm doing better. You are the arts editor.
I am.
And you have commissioned these pieces and it is a music special.
Yes, all of
those
that's true.
Facts yeah. are true. DJ Taylor once has said to me at a dinner that his dearest wish would be to write about the literary sensibility of Paul Weller and the Jam. And seeing as we're having a music issue, it has come to pass. He's going to join us shortly. And the issue opens with Stephen Brown taking an overview of books on the subject of the importance of music, its theory and practice. So to the Jam and Paul Weller, which would be a truly hip subject if this were 1976, the year the band could be found recording their debut album In the City. 40 years on, it's striking both how the songs and songwriting have endured, and also intriguing how they're written and constructed by young men without the benefit of a lengthy education, with an effect redolent of the football terrace, but also who managed to produce something recognisably literary too. DJ Taylor has made the case in the TLS this week for the buried literary sensibility of the Jam and joins us now. David.
Hello.
Perhaps you might give us a bit of context. There may be some listeners, indeed there are some TLS editors and podcasters, who were not born when The Jam first appeared.
Yes, well, it really was 40 years ago that I think I first saw them on the Mark Bolan show, it was in those days. And he was shortly to die, poor chap, Mark Bolan. But at that point, he was a rather faded glam rock star. And suddenly here were these three extraordinary young men, I mean, not much older than I was at the time. I was in the lower sixth at school, jumping around the stage like giant frogs, wearing these CNA suits and black and white correspondent shoes, they used to be called, producing this extraordinary, furious, distinctively modern noise. But if you knew anything about English pop music, which I did, you're obviously borrowing from the styles of the 1960s, and their early stuff was very much influenced by The Who, by Pete Townshend, Small Faces, people like that. So they were, to me, as a 16-year-old, they were both wonderfully up-to-date. You know, they were the latest new thing of this new wave of British music that had just started up. But they were also recognisably sort of belonging to, you know, English pop heritage as well. So you hit with both barrels in 1977 with the Jam.
Make the briefcase, I suppose, for the literariness of this stuff, because on one hand, as you say, it's sort of power pop music, but on the other, as your piece goes into, why do you feel they're somehow literary?
Well, the literariness and pop music is an odd thing. Usually, a lot of pop music, the original British pop music of the 60s was a working class phenomenon. It was said at the time, if you're an East Ender in 1964-5, the only way to get on was either through playing football, pop music, or organized crime. Fortunately, some people chose pop music. When pop then went middle class, which it began to do, you know, sort of post the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper, post the Beatles, progressive rock and all that kind of thing, literariness was usually very self-conscious and dropped in from above. What I mean by that is 20 years ago, for example, Blur did a song called Country House, which referenced Balzac, but it was just a kind of rather self-conscious rhyme. You know, he's reading Balzac, knocking back Prozac. It was very self-conscious. It just to show that Damon Albarn had read a few books. What I find in Paul Weller's early lyrics is that the literariness is kind of bubbling up from below. I mean, here was this, he was 18, 19 at the time, left school at 15 with no qualifications to speak of, but clearly through some kind of osmotic process, you know, the virus of literature had taken up residence in his veins. And he's not sort of consciously doing this. It's just how he writes and how his mind works. And you get these wonderful kind of, what I mean by literary images, I mean, there's a wonderful song on their third album called Billy Hunt, which obviously borrows from Keith Waterhouse's Billy Liar, you know, the fantasist. When I develop my bionic arms, the whole world's going to wish it weren't born. But it's not just these kind of shouted 1, 2, 3, 4 lyrics. There are some wonderfully sort of sinuous alliterative bits in there where Billy Hunt's on his side that he's going to satisfy any whim that I wanted to.
Perhaps we should have a little listen to that. That's that's Billy Hunt, and that's off the album All Mod Cons, isn't it, from 1978.
If it's not you moaning, then it's someone else jamming down my throat every chance you get. If it's not you crying, then it's probably me. You little dog messing up my tree. Billy Hunt is a magic.
All Mod Cons is, according to Weller, the album where his literariness, as you put it, is that his word? I mean, that's when it started to show.
I think he did say something. He started getting more literary, as he put it, at that point. But the earlier stuff is still quite literary. I mean, there are references to 1984 on their second album, This Is the Modern World, where at the end of one song, his voice falls out. And remember, you know what happened to Winston. And it's Winston Smith he's talking about from 1984. Which again, you know, sort of brought me up with a start when I first listened to that, aged, I don't know, 16 or something, back in 1977.
Billy Hunt is itself, it's a quite perfect work of short fiction, really, isn't it?
Well, this is the other thing about his early songs, that they do have this, I think it's something he may well have got from some of those mid-60s Beatles songs like She's Leaving Home, you know, the Paul McCartney one off Sgt. Pepper, but they do tell little stories. I mean, the most famous, the best-known example of this, I suppose, is another wonderful track off All Mod Cons called Down in the Tube Station at Midnight, which is basically about this man coming back with a takeaway curry for his wife, getting the last tube and being beaten up by some right-wing thugs.
I think we're going to have to hear a little bit of that one, yeah, as well.
Just an echo. But faraway voices bought in faraway trains to take them home to the
who was that they love and who loved them forever.
It starts out quite lyrically, this, the distant echo of faraway voices boarding faraway trains.
To take them home to the wives that they love and who love them forever. I'm quoting this from memory. I've not even got the lyric in front of me. And then it all gets very sharp and hard and immediate. You know, he talks about the lads are beating up. You know, they smelt of pubs and wormwood scrubs and too many right-wing meetings. The last thing I last saw lying there on the floor is Jesus Saves, painted by an atheist nutter and a British Rail poster saying, have an away day, a cheap holiday, do it today. And it's bringing cliche and slogan and sort of contemporary advertising into this extraordinary resonant little vignette of violence and horror down in the tube station.
It sounds a bit like something from Anthony Burgess, maybe.
I'm not sure how far Weller had got with that. He was a great one for sort of seizing on books and writing about them before he'd actually read them. I mean, for example, in 1981 there's a jam single called Absolute Beginners from the Colin McInnes novel, and I think he just thought it was a great two words put together, and then he read the book afterwards. But you know, that's not to underestimate. I think the depth of his sensibility on these.
It
things.
Slightly reminded me in a different sense of something like Joyce and Ulysses, where you take things that are around you, and Joyce did the same thing with cliches and advertising slogans, where you're so saturated in what you're describing that you then find a way of turning it into art.
I think that's a very good point. And one of the other things I noticed about Weller's early stuff is this sense of walking through this kind of consumerist landscape filled with absolutely everything, where sensations are dropping on you on all sides and you're sort of picking your way. There's another very, very resonant early track of his called In the Crowd. Now, the crowd is a big symbol in English pop music. You know, it's the great sort of that great collectivist repository. The mod songs of the 60s always go on about crowds. And yet, the Weller or the persona who's walking through the crowd is sort of seeing all this stuff and responding to it, but still trying to preserve his own autonomy. And so they're one of the very interesting things to me about those songs is that although it's all communal, you know, we're all lads together, we're Saturday's kids. Well, I wasn't a Saturday's kid myself, but there's a jam song called Saturday's Kids. But at the same time, Weller is sort of very sharply exposing this collectivism, and at the heart of it is usually something very solitary, something quite vulnerable. And this was quite remarkable for the sort of rather angry, in-your-face British pop music of the late 1970s, which was quite a lot. It was very much rabble-rousing and confrontational. And this is too, to an extent, but there's a very sharp, vulnerable, sort of exposed, solitary core to it as well.
1976, 1977 is the Sex Pistols.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the Buzzcocks. And that's wonderful stuff, but that's not the same kind of sensibility at all.
No, it isn't.
And it's nowhere near the complexity or anything like that. They're not telling stories. As you say, it's more of a kind of battle cry.
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. You see, what the punk explosion did, and Weller was very influenced by that. I mean, he went and saw the Sex Pistols very early stage. And they kind of gave a conduit, you know, to the sort of song. Well, I think one of the things that can probably be said about the punk explosion of 76, 77 was that it provided a very good vehicle for songwriters with genuine talent to make their first mark and then go on and do something else. I'm thinking of people like Elvis Costello, for example, exactly at the same time, or Howard Devoto, who was the original Buzzcocks vocalist and then famously went off to found a band called Magazine, who were influenced, you know, who wrote songs about Dostoevsky.
Yeah.
So it was a very good way of
they were a bit more self-conscious, though, weren't
that's
they?
That's right, a bit more self-conscious. Whereas, you see, the thing I find about Weller is that he's not being self-conscious.
No, not at
all. It's just how he writes. You know, it's how his words come out.
I can't help but think of Ian Curtis, though, in there, because the same year that All Mod Cons came out, you've got An Ideal for Living, and Ian Curtis is, he's very much, people have spoken, you know, John Savage and Robert Palmer, I mean, not that Robert Palmer, have spoken about the literariness of his lyrics and the influences of J.G. Ballard and William Burroughs.
It was said of that whole Manchester music scene of the late 70s is again saturated in heavyweight sort of into, you know, European fiction.
And science fiction.
Somebody once said that there was a famous second-hand bookshop in Manchester which had stocks of, you know, old Russian novels, and that's where they went to buy their books. Mm. and so you get a Joy Division number like Dead Souls from 1979, which is, you know, consciously based on but Weller's not like that. It's just stuff he picks up in the same way that the songs are full of sort of slight, there are odd biblical references as well, you know. So the boy who sat there at school assembly obviously this stuff had sort of, you know, leaked into his cerebral cortex and is sort of coming out again, and this rather ornate way of writing as well. I mean,
there's deviously ornate, which I think is a lovely way of putting it.
I'm thinking their very last single, Beat Surrender, you know. It's almost like a sort of Victorian love letter, and well as talking to his fans, and he says, "And I shall be forever beholden to the bit beholden to."
Fancy
using a phrase
to
like that in a number one pop single. I shall be beholden to the beat surrender. I think that's a wonderful line.
I was thinking about when you say he's steeped in Orwell, and that kind of makes a lot of sense because they were quite political. He's quite a political animal, always has been. Mm. So you think, well, that, you know, that makes a lot of sense that he's read a lot of Orwell and it's very influential. What I found more surprising was the kind of English pastoral, Peter Pan, Wind in the Willows, which
the English pop pastoral strain, I think, probably it comes from Pink Floyd's Pipe at the Gates of Dawn, 1967.
Sure.
But then all of that late 1960s stuff by bands like Traffic and so forth was English pastoralism.
But that's very much the middle class thing that you were talking about.
Pink Floyd,
he got this, I think, from growing up. And there's some wonderful lines in the early songs. He was born in Woking, and there are these lines about, you know, I know his solo album, Stanley Road, there's a line about, you know, the Surrey Hills, where I took my time, you know, that wonderful idea of youthful sort of innocence and pleasure and so forth. And again, there's a line that in Tales from the Riverbank where he suddenly, the voice turns and says, but now you don't get so many to the pound.
That sounds more like the Paul Weller that you might expect.
Yeah, but it's
rather than
awful,
the person.
You see, another classic sort of instance, I suppose, why he fits so well into that British pop tradition is the dolefulness. It's the doleful voice, the slight sort of fatalistic air. And
you mentioned Tales from the Riverbank. That's probably the last one we should listen to, which we'll do now. This is a kind of Orwellian song, isn't it?
It is. There is actually a reference to it, to the Golden Country. The Golden Country, which Winston Smith talks about to Julia when they meet that time, sort of somewhere west of London in 1984. He says, a Golden Country which I've been to in a dream. And, you know, that's a very precise reference.
I mean, because you talk about pop's buried literary sensibility. Mm. And we've talked about kind of pop's sort of showy-offy, ostentatious literary sensibility, which you've referred to. Do you think there are other examples of where effectively an education, sometimes a very basic comprehensive education, coupled with a lust for learning, has led to other people doing the same thing, not showing off, just letting it just leach out into their music?
So you could imagine a situation now where a young Paul Weller would be hoiked off to university and do a creative writing degree and all, you know, the hoops through which you have to jump to be a writer these days, and I think it would probably rather sort of warped his mind rather than, you know, allowed it to develop on its own terms. So I think it's I think in some ways in terms of his particular art, I think this was the best way for him to develop, is the fact that he was undereducated, if you like, that gives him his distinction as a pop writer.
Well, I think David, you've definitely made the case for Paul Weller. I'm so glad we had that conversation where you said
It was about 11 o'clock at night, wasn't it? It was 11 o'clock at night in a room in Soho after dinner. I said, I know what I'd like to do. And amazingly enough, you said yes.
Yeah. Great.
How much had you been drinking at that?
Amazing what he will agree to at 11 o'clock in a room in Soho.
No, exactly. I fulfilled a dream.
Yeah. Talking to you now, it has your kind of passion for it sort of leaps forward, which is wonderful. So thank you so much for writing, and thank you for joining
us. Wonderful, done it. Thanks very much, everyone. Cheers.
When I spoke to him the first time, you could tell how much he loved the Jam.
His enthusiasm is so clear.
But the case seems to me to be incontrovertible. Mm. This is not someone who wishes the Jam were more literary and has kind of sort of squeezed it out there. And you guys like the Jam. They're a meaningful band for you, despite your youthful aspect.
Now, I like the Jam, and I was saying to Thea earlier that I didn't like them on principle because my brother liked them. So I knew. So it's that thing where you know all the songs, but I thought, oh, well, that's not mine. And then I realised actually when you listen to it properly, it was really good. So I did know a lot of the songs, but I didn't get those references at all, actually. The ones I could remember is yeah, They Smelt of Pubs and Wormwood Scrubs and the kind of Stop Up Your Beer and Collect Your Fags. If you'd asked me before I'd read this, I'd have said...
Do you know what I think is that David is probably a product of a generation and we're probably half and half in this, the people who studied sleeve notes, where when you got an album, this was true of CDs as well, where you read the, you know, the book of lyrics came with the album.
Because you read the lyrics, not because of what they said on the back, but because because you actually read the lyrics.
And the lyrics were there. And if you really loved a band, you'd look at the lyrics. And I remember, I used to write them in books at school and stuff.
I was thinking about that on the way in today. And I was thinking about how you would buy the CD. I would, my generation anyway, buy the CD and then take the sleeves out, read them all, rewrite them, as you say, and then probably put the sleeve, because it was always a kind of an accordion sleeve, and then you'd paste it onto your wall with blue tack, and you would just be surrounded by the words, and somehow that.
I remember my mum worked in a school in Leicestershire, and we used to give her CDs, and she should go and sneak in and photocopy and laminate them. And then we'd have posters of the CDs. I remember Appetite for Destruction by Guns N' Roses.
Oh, that's a fairly horrible one.
Which is not that. I don't think Guns N' Roses are that good. Very good record.
Very good record.
Arguably one of the best rock records ever, but not a literary record.
No,
fair enough.
Not a very nice cover, if I remember rightly.
Yeah, it's sort of cross and black, a bit gothic metal.
Can't remember it properly.
Shall we move on? But fascinating stuff. Well, let's move from pop music to all music. Stephen Brown has reviewed 5 books containing advice on how to practice it, listen to it, and appreciate it. It takes in Murakami's conversations with Seiji Ozawa, Michael Hamper's The Crafty Art of Opera, and Fiona Maddock's Music for Life. The article considers, inter alia, the Asian embrace of Western classical music, which Brown ranks as among cultural history's most startling phenomena, the rise of Mahler in the 1960s, the 100 most important classical works ever, and this startling question about modern background noise. What does a child today grow up hearing? The hum of traffic, a medley of electronic beeps, the fracas of garbage trucks, whoosh of air conditioners, car alarms, leaf blowers, jets overhead, TV sets murmuring or shouting. What is the impact on musicality of such a noisy world? Well, Stephen Brown can help us delve into all of this and joins us now. Okay, Stephen, well, shall we begin with the rise of Western classical music in the East, which you refer to relatively early on in your piece? I hadn't really taken the trouble to think about, but when you mention it, it is a hugely important cultural event. What do you think accounts for it, and how big a deal is it?
I think that Western music just fills a gap that that those cultures have.
You mentioned that young string players the world over are taught according to the methods of the Japanese musician and philosopher Shinichi Suzuki. He didn't screen children for their abilities, so he acted on the principle that any child had the potential to become a world-class musician.
There must be something innate in terms of talent, mustn't it? I mean, you've seen a lot of people as a music professor who you've taught music to. Do you think there is an aspect of innate talent within some people?
Yeah, you know, it's a funny thing within a music department. You know, you have maybe 200 students or something, and some of them are better than others, obviously. But even amongst those who are among the best, let's say the best as students and so on, the professors will say, well, so-and-so isn't really musical. I mean, it's just not uncommon to hear that. Someone else might disagree with me, but I mean, I was still quite certain that I can hear musicality or not hear. And playing with other musicians also, in chamber music, you have a feel for it.
You're nodding to that, Lucy. Do you agree with that?
Yes, and I don't. I think it is a gut reaction, and anybody can have it. Actually, I don't think you need to have done. I think you need to know what the music is, but within whatever music you know, if you've got a feel for it, then you kind of know if it's sometimes it's about personalities. but sometimes, but a lot of the time, there are people who can play the notes, but it might not feel especially
it
musical
might not
to you.
Jump out. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Stephen, I was going to ask you if I might, the thing about the kind of the primacy almost of Western classical music, because it's not only in China and Japan, is it? There's also this whole the whole Sistema thing, you know, from Venezuela and the way they're teaching the kids there, which is a bit the same sort of idea as a Suzuki, because all the kids are taught the same way, you know, and again,
and they're street kids, aren't they? Very often?
Absolutely, it doesn't matter where they are, but yeah, they are street kids because a lot of it was just about getting them off the street. But also, that's they've kind of revitalized, certainly over here, I think they've revitalized quite a lot of kind of rather stock classical works that people perhaps were a bit fed up of. So it's not only, it seems to me that it's not only about what you were saying about Chinese and Japanese culture, it's about the way you approach that music. Do you see what I mean? Because it's a very European tradition, what they're playing in Venezuela. They're playing Beethoven and Bruckner and, you know, they're playing all the Austro-German stuff.
I do have a feeling that there is a younger generation of musicians who somehow are able to just, like, you know, approach the music with some kind of freshness, to just to not be constricted by you know, every other interpretation that's ever been heard, and kind of, you know, it's kind of like these revolutions that occur in religion, where there, you know, there's layers of priesthood that pile up, you know, between you and God, and then somebody comes along and says, no, no, you don't need that. You can just talk directly to God yourself. And I think the same thing is in music. You know, every once in a while someone comes along and says, well, you know what? I don't need Serkin. You know, I can just talk to Ludwig van Beethoven myself.
I saw Dudamel's orchestra do Mahler's Fifth, I think, a few years ago. And the Murakami book discusses the championing of Mahler by Leonard Bernstein. And my dad introduced me to Mahler when I was quite young. And I was slightly surprised to see his symphonies are regarded as difficult, because to my very untutored ear, it always felt kind of romantic and lush and sentimental. In what way do you think Mahler is difficult, or I suppose the sort of Bernstein recognition that Mahler was difficult?
Well, I mean, I always thought that that Mahler was lush and romantic and so on. In reading that book, I realized that there's a whole other way of looking at Mahler, which is looking at him as a modernist. You know, my favorite, actually, piece of Mahler's, On My Beloved's Wedding Day, in the midst of the lush, romantic, orchestral texture. And this little Jewish folk song just suddenly, you know, just appears. And it's shocking, you know, but it's beautiful. And but that kind of juxtaposition of two different kinds of music in the same piece, it's actually very modernist.
It sounds the Murakami book, it sounds like an interesting book. I mean, do we get a sense of how the conversations came about? I mean, one can speculate as to why Murakami, a writer known for his mental and physical discipline and his studies of solitude, you can speculate as to why he might be attracted to a man whose own life and work are built on those things.
Murakami is just the biggest fan of music, you know, you can imagine. He's so in love with music. It means so much to him, and he doesn't really know anything about music in a technical sense. But Murakami remembers, like, particular moments, like, well, right about 4 minutes and 30 seconds into the second movement, you know, you hear this. And so, I mean, that's something I could never do. So, I mean, he understands Mahler on a level deeper than my own.
Before we go, Stephen, you reviewed Fiona Maddock's Music for Life, which proposes 100 works for music to carry you through life. Perhaps just a way of ending this, do you want to propose one or more than one piece of music that you would add to that list, or pick out from that list, or what that someone should go and listen to, perhaps hasn't heard it before, the music that would help you carry you through?
Okay, well, how about that one that I mentioned a minute ago, on My Sweetheart's Wedding Day by Mahler. I mean, that's just astonishingly beautiful and, you know, crazy and modern and full of emotion. That's a piece that could carry you through.
Well, listen, Stephen, thank you so much. As I said, it's a musical issue of the TLS, and yours is the lead piece, and it covers such a broad... We haven't had even a chance to scrape half of what you've been saying in your piece. It's a wonderful piece, and thank you so much.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
For joining us.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for the kind words.
I like the sound of the Michael Hamper book, The Crafty Art of Opera.
Well, we have an opera person here.
We do. I love the sound of all the aphorisms in it. I wrote a few down. Where are they? Oh, his lessons, yes, for performers and audience. Things like, the basis of understanding is who wants what from whom and why. Develop a feeling for greatness. It protects against stupidity.
But it is. It's really good. And actually, it doesn't have to be about opera. Because I started reading it, and it's true what Stephen says in his review is that it looks like it's supposed to be a sort of handbook. And I picked it up because we wouldn't necessarily, you know, do review something like that. But I started reading it and I thought it was brilliant because it's not just for opera.
It's a manual for life.
Well maybe not all life. No, but certainly for performance. Because that point about, what did you just say? Where is it? What
develop a feeling for... Oh, no, the basis of understanding who wants what from whom and why.
Exactly. And that's the basis. That's what people need to know when they're on stage. Mm. Otherwise, you get people just kind of wandering about. Mm.
The West Wing.
It's the basis of all drama, who wants what, and exactly.
And life.
Yeah. But if you're clear about it on stage, you have to be clear about it. Otherwise, nobody cares what's going on. This is what actors train in. What's your motivation? That big cliche. It's absolutely true. And he says these things very clearly. Mm. What do you want when you go on stage? Who are you talking to?
Don't fumble.
Don't fumble. Exactly. We were talking about this, Stig, with your Shakespeare reviews, when people sort of pick things up and start doing something else. Like your man who is...
Yeah. Take the clothes off ordinarily.
Yeah, or the man that you had that was doing gym exercises while
he did the side plank.
Yeah, there you go.
In King Lear.
That's fumbling and fiddling, essentially, because you don't have enough belief in it.
Is the danger in opera that you either have people who just stand there and belt it out with no sense of drama, or you have people who dramatise to the point where they're not singing beautifully? Is it very hard to get that sense of a clean, dramatic action?
Yes, it's hard. It's hard to do. It's just as hard in musical theatre, by the way. It's not unique to opera, that. But yes, it's one of the things that Hamper says as well. He says, he says to the singers, maintain your relationship with your partner, which is absolutely crucial. You have to do that anyway. Avoid the tenor's turn, which means the tenor's turn means this is my aria. I'm now going to turn to the audience and sing it at them because that's where you get the maximum volume and effect. But I'm supposed to be singing it to the person next to me because I'm in love with her or whatever. Yeah. But actually, I'm going to turn around to the audience and say, I love you. But actually,
remember what you want and from whom.
And this is my high note. But that's not what you're supposed to be doing. You're supposed to be communicating, you know, that you love her or that you've got to leave her or whatever it is. But you're not supposed to be communicating how good your top C is. That's not the point of the exercise.
And you and I had a drink with Guy de Man, who's our opera critic the TLS, a fine man. And he talked about being moved to tears fairly regularly going to watch opera. Do you think that's a common reaction to it?
I can't vouch for it. It certainly happens to me.
Does it?
Absolutely.
Happens to Julia Roberts in Pretty Woman.
There you go. It happens to all the best people, me and Guy and Julia Roberts
in Pretty Woman.
Well, that's what it should do. That's what, when you go and see La Boheme, you're not supposed to be kind of going at the end, oh, well, that didn't turn out so well.
No.
In Madame Butterfly, that's what we were talking about with Guy.
Yeah.
It's a tragic, tragic story. And there's something quite moving, not just in the story, but I think the reason it's moving is because you can't sing that stuff without being at the absolute peak of what you can do and without giving everything. You just can't do it. You won't get the notes out. You won't get the lines out.
So in some ways, because I'm trying to think of the analogy with Shakespeare, where now to move a tragedy, just to move someone, they've got to make an audience who doesn't speak Shakespearean English understand what's going on, the emotion, the heft of it.
Yeah.
And with opera, you often have to do that in a completely different language that the audience might not speak. Is the music, I suppose, not a further barrier? It's actually a door
through that. But it's also, because it's a sort of physical effort, it's also, I think, a bit like watching an athlete. You're applauding the human effort and the emotion and the writing.
But I find that off-putting, because I saw Glenda Jackson in Lear for the paper, and that was an 80-year-old woman performing
however many lines she has to know, which is 2,000 lines. It's a very physically demanding role. She's by the end of it, she's sort of physically changed. She sort of half strips at one point and then just gets sort of returned to a different costume. And there's this massive physical effort. And you come away with, I came away thinking is, oh my God, what a physical achievement, not least for someone of her age. And that to me, though, is a distraction rather than a compliment.
Yes, I see what you mean. I think you shouldn't ever be worried about the actor or the singer, because then that's it. You've had it.
But
you
even if you're
can't be worried.
But even if you're impressed
them.
By the athletic, because doing Lear is a physical feat. Anyone does. It's a feat of memory.
You shouldn't be impressed by just the fact that they're doing it.
Yeah, and that's
it has to be that you're moved by it, and also they're going for it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because if they're not going for it, then how will you feel the full force of it? But you shouldn't just be going, oh yes, look how engaged they are.
Well, I can't.
Because then you're not.
I came out of that Lear thinking, oh, Christ, how the hell did she manage to do that?
Yeah.
That's brilliant. But it was brilliant and she was very good. But
you were not sort of taken up with it.
Yeah, I wasn't moved.
Else.
It wasn't at all. I mean, as a play generally, it wasn't at all moving.
Well, that's kind of the job, isn't it? As well. I mean, that's not the only job, but it's certainly part of it.
I think it must be. That's about all we have time for, alas. So let us thank the lovely DJ Taylor, Stephen Brown, and the ever operatic Lucy Dallas. And let me remind you to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back every week this year with thoughts on big pieces in the TLS and much else. This week's paper, music special, thanks to Lucy Dallas, includes all you've just heard, plus New York disco at the beginning of the 1980s, hip hop and black consciousness, and the Beatles on acid. We'll also cover Ginsberg and Kerouac, the love affairs of François Mitterrand, and black and Asian writing in post-war pre-Brexit Britain. And Lucy Dallas, I have been working for you this week, reviewing the new 12th Night at the National Theatre, which stars Tamsin Gregg as Malvolia. And so I've seen four, I think, Shakespearean productions for you in the last few months. Three have had female actors playing the lead. Everything in Shakespeare is gender switching in the sense that all the women were played by boys anyway.
Exactly.
So it's kind
by
of inherent.
Definition, it's
and 12,
there.
And 12th Night, the pretty much the main gag is a boy plays a girl playing a boy.
Yep.
So this feels very natural and normal to me and kind of adds to it. I mean, I find in Midsummer Night's Dream, when Helenus loves Demetrius, you end up with this sort of same-sex frisson. And actually in the 12th Night, there was this sort of Satobi Belch and Andrew Aguecheek same-sex frisson, which was kind of interesting and sad and funny. So I think, I mean, is this the new tradition? Because I think someone in the Telegraph wrote a blustering piece, which I only read about four paragraphs of because it sort of was harumphing so loudly I couldn't hear myself think. But this is the end of the role for male actors. Because you women, you upstart women are coming in and taking the food from their mouths.
Yeah. Well, you know, they have been doing it for 400 years, so I figure we could have one or two. No, listen, I think it's just not. Now what happens is that people think about the play and they think about how it would be interesting and they cast the best person.
Yeah.
And as you say, what it does is add to the complexity and the richness, so I don't see how that can be a problem. There really is no lack of parts for male actors. No. That's really not the deal.
And either I think it adds to it in the sense of it's already a comedy about sex swapping, which pretty much all the comedies
are. Exactly. There's so much of it there anyway.
That it adds to it. It's brilliant. Or in the case of Glenda Jackson, say, it actually didn't matter that she was a woman.
Yeah.
It just had nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
She was just a good actor and she happened to be a woman, but there wasn't even a thematic or broader point being made. It was just here's and that, because some and that seems to work in both ways, doesn't it? Either you're making a point or you're not making a point at all, in which case so much the better.
But also I mean, reasonably recently there have been revivals of all male productions and there was no was there a lot of harumphing there? I don't know, but it's fine. Do all male productions, do all female productions, just do whatever.
Yeah,
I mean, I would
rather than instead of.
Exactly. And also, as I say, there really have been a lot of all male productions.
But do you think it's a trend? Is it? I mean, the sort
it's
the sort,
quite yes.
Well, it seems to be in that it's
at the moment,
you know, the rule of three.
Yeah,
three happenings.
Yeah,
but I think it's. I mean, I hope it's more than a trend because I hope that's just the way people cast it now, rather than people going, "Oh, well, obviously, I can't play X or Y." It's like, didn't Catherine Hunter, didn't she play? Was it Lear? She played a big Shakespearean character ages ago before anyone else did, and she was kind of an outlier, and everyone thought, "Oh, look, it's like a dog walking on its hind legs. How odd!" But actually, she's a great actor.
Yeah,
you know, why can't she play that?
I think the comedies particularly. Why wouldn't you do it?
Especially the comedy.
Because they are just there to be done. And Midsummer Night's Dream and 12th Night, it actually made both of those things more fun.
Mm.
and more interesting and more in depth. I don't think anyone came out of it thinking, oh God, I wish they hadn't. And Tamsin Gregg, by the way, if you have a chance to go to this, she's absolutely mesmerically brilliant. And part of it, I think, is the audience likes her anyway, and so she's famous. And so she has a slight advantage in that people are sort of selling her gags as she's delivering
them. She's done quite a lot of Shakespeare before as well. Yeah. It's not like she's not like a telly actress who hasn't done before.
But people wanted
they
to like
her. They just like her anyway,
But I would say almost half of the gags in her are in the play from her are just leaving a beat after a line or staring at someone
in the
front row.
She's a wonderful comedian.
And the sort of physical gestures and pointing at people and... It was just this great lesson in physical comedy. Mm. And, you know, you couldn't take your eyes off her for the whole thing. She was like a rock star, and it was exceptional thing to watch. And Michael Caine's The Doctor, our great Shakespearean, he liked it as well.
He liked it as well.
Which I was pleased about because I'd filed the review saying how much I liked it, and then he went to see it the day after and came back saying he really liked it.
There we go.
It's official.
Well, yeah, exactly. Although he did say, and I have to update you next week, he said, I liked it all except for one scene.
Oh,
and then I've not yet confronted him about what that.
What a cliffhanger!
I know. Okay. I'll find that out. So that's also in the paper as well. You can visit our website to read that, the-tls.co.uk, or anything else, and learn more about our print and digital subscriptions. And do come back daily to the site for new original pieces from TLS writers, including a really good piece by Sarah Perry on readability, arguing that books are not better for being difficult. Our own Adrian Tohordin on the scandals of the French presidency, and Sophie Brown on what books can do to reform prisoners. You can follow us on Twitter @TheTLS, like us on Facebook, and review us on iTunes. Next week, we really have a bumper spring books issue, 48 pages, which includes an extract from the hugely exciting new George Saunders novel, Lincoln in the Bardo. And we should be playing, Theo, shan't we, an extract from the audiobook?
Indeed.
See if we can manage that level of technicality for this podcast. And he mentioned it, so we should play out with Stephen Brown's recommended song. Theo,
yes.
Do you have the title?
On My Sweetheart's Wedding Day, the Marla.
The Marla.
On My Sweetheart's Wedding Day.
So we will play out to that. So until then, from Theo, from Lucy, and from me, goodbye.